Okay, we were in chapter 10, the latter part of it. He has really begun throughout the rest of the book, essentially an exhortation that he's been exhorting all along, interspersed throughout some of the doctrinal material, this idea of encouragement to maintain the faith, to stay the course, and he continues that line as we go on into 10, 11, and following. We've gotten down to section 32 and following. I'd asked you a question just by way of a little bit of review to get into this. He's trying to encourage them to be faithful, and he has he's using a couple of techniques in this latter part of chapter 10 to motivate them. What was the one we started studying last week?
Fear.
Last Sunday. Fear. Fear is a motivation. And now in this section, 32, and for the end of the chapter, what's the motivation he's drawing on?
Reward.
Okay, the reward is in front of them. That's true.
You know they have a better possession.
You know they have a better possession. That's true.
Heaven.
I like the way y'all key on that. Yeah. Rest, all of the above. But maybe I need to ask the question a little differently. What's he telling them to remember? What's he calling them to remember?
All
the things they've gone through. I mean, you've gotten this far, and there's something in front of you. Don't give up now. Look at what you've suffered. Remember we talked about a little bit about the sufferings. In fact, he delineated some of them in 32, 3, and 4. And as y'all pointed out, answered, they were looking forward to something better. Right? And he makes this a good contrast. As part of the suffering they went through, what had it cost them? At least something. Not yet. Not these people. Yeah. About Christians in general. That's true.
Land,
property, cattle. Whatever. They had lost their possessions, some of them. Very last part of 30, middle part of 34. And then he says, hey, you've joyfully accepted that. Because you have something better that you're living for in the last part of 34. And so it's a contrast that the Bible makes all the time. Jesus preached it, the apostles preached it. There is something more important than the things on this earth. And we certainly live in a country that we're blessed with things. And these people, because of their faith, had lost some of those things, but they had confidence, and they were looking forward to something that was much, much better. As he's gone through this section, he's really kind of taking the opposite side of, or different way of stating it, I guess. Been saying, hold fast, hold fast, hold fast. And here he says it, again, but in a different way, and that is, don't give up. Stay your course. Don't give up. Endurance and faith. I asked you a question in verse 36, starting in verse 36. What two things the Hebrews need as they look forward to, or look toward what God has promised?
Endurance,
confidence, and
faith,
and do the will of God. Obedience. Okay, and that's no different than it's stated throughout the Bible. And when the Bible talks about the kind of endurance that we'll talk about in chapter 11, of course, he's talking about an endurance that trusts in God, has the faith to trust in God, and we'll see that reinforced throughout chapter 11 as well. As we enter into, let's pick up here in 36. 32 through 34, we're talking about all these sufferings they've been through. And in 35, he tells them, don't throw away your confidence. In other words, don't give up. Don't give up on this hope that they have before them. In 35, because there is a great reward in front of them. And for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. For yet in a little while, a very little while, he who is coming will come, and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in it. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. I ask you a question. Where does this come from? This quote?
Habakkuk.
What are the circumstances in Habakkuk?
Habakkuk is asking the Lord, what was he going to do something about the people being persecuted?
Yeah, the times are bad in Judah, aren't they? And we're time frame of Habakkuk is probably somewhere 605, 610 B.C. What may have already happened in one case, but what will happen in the next 30, at least within the next 30 years?
Southern Kingdom? Destruction of the temple.
600 B.C. When's Jerusalem destroyed? His temple destroyed? 586, right? And it may have already had first captivity when Habakkuk was written. So Habakkuk, you know, here it is. Things are bad in Judah. And they're under duress. And he's asked how long. And probably, I say Seth, the first exile, but it may not have been because of what he asked in the very front of it. And God answers it. He's going to bring the Chaldeans in. And, of course, that's disturbing. But toward the end of chapter, toward the end of the book, you learn something about Habakkuk's attitude and the attitude of the remnant, really, that would be, that was in Judah at the time. And he challenged them by his own statement, I suppose, to wait on the Lord. That's basically what choice they had, wait on the Lord. So you see this comment in Habakkuk 2.3, which is the reference in verse 37, there is judgment coming. And that's in Habakkuk's time. And that judgment, in that case, was going to be on Judah. Okay. But as he says in Habakkuk, and this writer writes, but my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in it. Just like then, just like throughout time, God looks for faithful people. And we'll see this idea of the righteous will live by faith repeated time and again. Now, think with me for a minute about application here. Know what it is in Habakkuk's time. There's a judgment coming of Israel. What's the judgment? And this is a judgment coming. It says so. I mean, we're familiar with that kind of terminology when God says he is, as he says here, in a little while he is coming, will come, and will not delay. So there's a judgment in view in that statement. What kind of judgment? What is the judgment? What do you think the judgment is? Think about the book. Think about the people. Think about the circumstances. Think about the life of time. What's going to happen?
Destruction of Jerusalem by Rome, 70 AD.
Very parallel kind of account as far as the nature of the events. Those who, and I want you to just think about this for a minute in terms of what he's already said in 32 through 4 about what they've been undergoing. And they were suffering. Was there reason to fall back? He spent 10.5 chapters trying to convince them that there was nothing to fall back to in terms of their soul. But were they challenged by the environment to fall back?
Yes.
It must have been, or we didn't spend so much time talking about it. And God's telling, this writer by inspiration is telling these people that judgment's coming. And that judgment is on, in this case, Jerusalem, but what it really boils down to is the final judgment of the system under the old law that some people are still trying to maintain. So if you're being persecuted by that system, I was using an example with Linda when I was talking to her about this section. If you're a U.S. citizen and you find yourself overseas, and you find out, you know, you get word that the United States government has fallen, been invaded by China, pick something out of the air, and has fallen, and there is no more United States. What's that do to your? What would that do to you? Change your focus a little bit? Are you a citizen anymore of the United States?
Not if there's no more United States.
If you're under, if you viewed yourself under the Jewish system, and that system got destroyed, the priest lineage is destroyed, the temple is destroyed. You think that has an impact on what people that were persecuting the Christians would do? They'd be on a different wavelength at that time. And I think that's probably what happened. Oh, I don't say probably, the secular history would tell you exactly what happened. When Jerusalem fell, that was essentially the end of Jewish persecution of Christians. There would be other persecutions to come, but not this. So here you have him, here you have the writer telling these people, stay the course. Trust. What he's really saying is, trust me. Trust God. I'm be the writer. Trust God. He's going to bring relief. And it won't be very long. And it wouldn't be very long. Okay? So that's the best fit I have in this section as to why this writer is dealing with this the way he is. And it's consistent with going back to what we said in chapter 10, chapter 10, verse 25, encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. I think that's the day of describing he's looking for the destruction of Jerusalem or the temple. Okay, any questions about that?
I have a question.
Yes, you.
I understand the point he's making. I just had a question about the latter part of 1038. What is that reference to in Habakkuk? Is that a paraphrase?
Oh, you mean because of the wording?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's direct quote out of the Septuagint.
Okay. That's okay. Missing.
Sorry?
That's missing.
Not in my Bible, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. At least I don't think it was.
Did it back? It
was not.
Huh?
Yeah, the first part of
38. Yeah. Get your new Bible. Hey, where am I? Where are you? Get the right chapter.
2:4.
Right.
We were the same one. We got the righteous one.
For the righteous, what was the point? What was that? I may have missed the point.
The last part of 38.
But the righteous will live by faith.
No, and if he shrinks back, my son will play. That's not in Habakkuk.
Oh, I'm sorry. Look at the Septuagint. That's where you'll find it.
Okay.
But remember, I think I mentioned this, that all the quotes, every quote in here out of the Old Testament comes out of the Septuagint.
I'm surprised that the translator didn't put it in here, since it has a direct reference in the Big Testament. You can find it. It's worded differently.
Yeah, right. But that's what it is.
So we might be quick to dismiss this section since it's talking about the imminent destruction of Jerusalem. It has no bearing on us. There is an application here, even though it's, you have to make the application without losing the initial thought. So.
Yeah, the one thing that, and I recognize as I teach this, that I run the risk of, and because of the nature of the book, I have not emphasized a lot of different applications you could make. Okay, there are a lot of applications you indeed can make. There's a lot the book tells us about our God and our Savior, and about how God made provision for us through time, and how God prepared the way for what would happen when Christ came to the earth through the administration of the old law. I mean, there's just so many lessons in this, and then when it comes, there's a fundamental lesson that comes out, I think, in Hebrews, and that's the one that's the thing. That's the one that is the reason he wrote the letter, and it applies to us just as much as it applies to them. And that's to be an encouragement to endure. We have different circumstances. We definitely aren't going to have to face what first century Christians face in terms of the persecution of the Jews. It's just not our environment. But we have other problems, the nature of the world, sin, our own weaknesses, persecutions in some cases, that we can take a lesson out of Hebrews in terms of what this writer has continually encouraged these folks to do.
What about in verse 37? What is he referring to that there? I mean, I know it's a reference to Habakkuk, but
the judgment, right, in this context, is talking about, I think, the judgment that would come on the nation of Israel, the Jews.
So who's
the first
century.
In 37. For yet, when he was coming, will come, God in judgment.
So it's not talking about Jerusalem, it's talking about...
No, it's talking about the thing it's saying is, he who is coming will come and will not delay. That's typical language for judgment. God coming in judgment. The question is, what's he going to come in judgment on? Is it the end of time?
That's what I was about.
No.
It's Jerusalem.
In a little while. Just as he says, right. We're in a very little while.
Right. Okay.
All right. I remember I said chapter 10 is a good chapter for Calvin, and I'm going to kind of wrap it up. Calvinistic doctrine. And when you look at this section, I don't know, maybe you have a way of concluding that once saved, always saved, can survive this. I have a hard time seeing it. There's so much throughout this, going all the way back to 10:19, but even in this section, to deal with the fact that once saved, you're not always saved. You just look at verse 39. We are not those who shrink back to destruction, but those who have perseverance, who have faith in the preserving of the soul. There's your contrast. We can, you got one case you'd be saved, the other case you can pull back from that and be lost. And so even in that statement, you see two sides of that coin. Okay? Anything on 10 before we move into 11? Bottom line, in terms of this book, in terms of that section, trust God. Okay. To me, it's kind of interesting. If you look at 39, he makes this statement, but we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the preserving of the soul. Jump across chapter 11 to 12. Therefore, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily encumbers us, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. Chapter 11 is going to serve a very good purpose, but his logic path, if you like, short of the thing about the witnesses, he could have gone from the end of chapter 10 right over to chapter 12 as far as his thought process goes. But he's going to bring on board this what we call from time to time Hall of Fame, the Hall of Fame of Faith, faithful men, and reinforce this very statement in verse 38, my righteous ones will live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in it. And he's going to show how over time, men of faith have been, have been rewarded. And that's true in terms of the eternal view, in terms of the promises before him. Okay? So we'll see that as we go through chapter 11. Chapter 11, my main reason, the main thing I'm going to focus on chapter 11, we will talk about these people a little bit, but we're not going to try to go through and do a great exegesis of chapter 11. We're not going to go back and try to, look at every reference in the Old Testament to these people and what their lives were. He has an objective in mind as he goes through this. And that is to present to these people who were struggling, people of faith that they would know that had been under very trying circumstances, but had stepped out on their faith, trusting God, and look forward to something other than things on this earth. Okay, and that's really what he's trying to do as far as encouraging these brethren that they too can survive. It's not the life in front of them is not as dark as it might seem based on the physical. Let's read 1-3 of chapter 11. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. For by it the men of old gained approval. By faith we understand that the world is prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen is not made out of things which are visible. I ask you a question. What two things are faith in this statement, in this chapter?
Substance of things hoped for.
Sorry?
Substance of things hoped for.
Substance of things hoped for. If you got New American Standard, it says assurance, look at the footnote. It'll say substance. What's the second thing?
Conviction of things not seen.
Okay, conviction. If you got a New American, New King James, I think it will say evidence. Okay. And I will work on this just a little bit. I asked you the question, and I think you all will probably answer, knowing, is the faith being talked about here subjective or objective? Oh, maybe not.
It's personal, but it's objective.
Is it objective faith? In other words, heaven exists because your faith says it does. That's objective.
Objective
means it's something that can be
touched, felt.
Can heaven be
touched?
Okay.
Subjective.
It's subjective. I can go through all the words, but the thing, the substance is, the New King James makes it sound like heaven, that it's substance. Your faith is a substance of things hoped for. And it's, that's the idea of something physical. And in fact, look back in Hebrews 1:3. It says, and talking about Christ, and he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature. That word nature is this same word. And so it can be, the word can be objective.
Nature is the same word.
As assurance. So it can be. But in this case, it's obviously not. about the conviction or the evidence of things not seen? And evidence is, conviction is a better word, I think, but let's take the word evidence for a minute. Is your faith evidence of things not seen?
Yeah, faith in
is it objective evidence of things not seen? If things exist, have you seen heaven?
I would say that faith is always subjective. By its definition of faith, faith is opposite.
Just because you believe doesn't bring it to existence.
That's right. Just because, yeah. Just because you believe. Just because you trust it. It is, I asked you a question a little later on about verse 3. Verse 3 raises an interesting, maybe academically interesting. But does the visible things exist? Yeah, sure. We have no trouble understanding that the worlds exist. So that what is seen was not made out of things which are not seen. All right, fine. We don't even have to have faith that the earth exists, do we? We can see it. We can feel it. How do we know where it came from?
That's where faith comes
from. Faith.
Genesis.
Right. But that you read it, but that's your faith. You believe that. It's subjective, it's not objective. It's a fact whether you believe or don't believe. You can't prove it one way or the other. If you are an evolutionist, how did the earth get here? How did the universe get here?
Boom.
Big bang.
Big bang.
Now, here's the question, Mr. Evolutionist or Mrs. Evolutionist. Let's just say the Big Bang's real. What was before the Big Bang? I don't know of any evolutionist that starts off with, do you, Rocky, no energy, no matter? I mean, it always starts off with energy and matter somewhere, based on your studies. And point to Rocky because he's read a lot of their stuff. And yet, to theorize that this world is created out of a Big Bang is something that's based on faith, pure and simple. I can't prove it. You can't prove God created the earth. But you have the faith for that, don't you? And the reason you know that is because it was revealed. Yes.
Can we prove that George Washington was a man, that was the first president of the United States?
No, you can't.
But it's there's objective evidence that he was.
You can't prove it.
The president of the United States. There's no subjective.
But you can have evidence. There's no question you have evidence. But ultimately, unless you have the ability, at this point, to say who it is, you're going to have a hard time. Look, I don't want to go into very academic statement. The point is, I think the point for that is to recognize this is a subjective. Faith is subjective, just like your hope is subjective. Doesn't make it not real, it just means that your hope is built on, and that's subjective, and it's built on subjective faith. And that's what these, when you go into chapter 11, and you see these men and women all out. And I take the easy example. You take Noah. Had Noah ever seen rain? As far as we know.
Not as far as we know.
Is there
not like the rain that flooded the earth?
Is there any way that you could imagine in your wildest dream that the whole earth could be flooded?
Well, God told him it was.
That's how he knew.
Right.
Knew it was because he believed. He had faith. And faith in something he couldn't see.
Okay, so dinosaurs, proven.
Evidence.
There's evidence.
You've seen one?
I have not. My faith.
Anybody has seen it? People have seen it twice.
There's nothing in the Bible that would prevent or contradict the existence of dinosaurs.
The way you're right. Convicted about heaven.
Okay, let me finish my thought, okay. My question. My faith, and from the timing of the Bible, says the earth is so many years old. The evidence that people have found, where does that come in saying that they're saying the earth is much older than that?
Mm-hmm.
Which, yeah, so help me separate the two.
Well, I'll try to help you separate them briefly.
Okay.
And I don't pretend to know. Let me state it differently. Let me start this off differently. There is evidence. You got things. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's fossil records, whether it's the various strata of rock, whatever it is. It's just evidence. It's like in a murder trial. You got a knife. You got somebody said this. Somebody said that. You got some kind of evidence. You know, eyewitness. You got some kind of evidence. What you have to do is you have to take that evidence and now you have to interpret it. You and I start out with the same evidence. You and an evolutionist start out with the same evidence. The question is how you interpret it.
By all the evidence around it.
You both have the same evidence. You have nothing, he has nothing you don't have. But you're going to come to a different conclusion than he comes to. And I'm not going to get into the technical aspects of that because I'd be way out of school, and besides that, that's not the subject. But you both have the same evidence.
Okay.
The question is, what answer do you reach out of that? You reach an answer that God created the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And you reach that because you got a Bible that has given you confidence,
mm-hmm,
on the basis of all the things that have been recorded and, you know, how these things couldn't be without it, that God created the heavens and the earth. He comes up with a different answer. But his answer is no less based on faith than yours is.
Okay.
I'd alter that slightly and say that he has a rejection of evidence. His interpretation of the Bible is a rejection of evidence.
Perhaps.
And that's what makes it subjective?
You can argue that is not evidence. That's not rejection of evidence, son. That's rejection of an interpretation. Evidence you put your hands on, in fact.
So that's what would make it subjective?
Because you can both come to two different conclusions.
It's based on your opinion.
Okay.
Best way to look at objective and subjective. Simple word is objective is fact. This is a simplification. Objective is fact. Subjective is opinion.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's the easiest way.
Okay. That's great dumbing it down.
Okay. The reason for the reason for doing that is because as you go through and you think about your own situation, you think about these men are dealing with their crushed, really, in a God about things that haven't necessarily happened. You know, they're being told to do things. They're being told by God certain things would happen. He doesn't necessarily tell them how. And in our existence, we don't have God talking directly to us, but what we have is a Bible that records, here's God's plan, and here's what he's promised. And the question is, are we going to believe it and trust God even though we can't understand it? That's what the men and women in chapter 11 demonstrate time and again, throughout the Old Testament, demonstrate time and again. And let's run through a few of them and we'll see that. Maybe we'll get through this lesson. Look, in verse 2, he says, for yet, talking about now faith, and he says, for yet the men of old gained approval. as you go through, hopefully as you went through and as you have in the past, you go through Hebrews 11. You'll see statements like in verse 5. He says, talking about Enoch, he obtained the witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. You'll see in verse 7, How about verse 16? It said, God is not ashamed to be called their God because he has prepared a city for them. Talking about the patriarchs. They received a good testimony. Chapter 11, verse 2, you see carried out in the form of the rest of the chapter. These are people that did things based on their faith and received a good testimony from God. Okay? And in some cases it's in the section, some cases it's back where you read about their lives. And in all cases, the testimony is in the scripture. We have a record of their life. Now, it's not necessarily that was is indicative of approval, but certainly is a testimony. Okay? I'd ask you, look, you had a choice and do it either way. My main interest was to go through and look at the men and women and hear what they did, what was the outcome of their actions, anything that was said about them, really for you to see this kind of come through. As we start off with Abel, says, by faith Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous. God testifying in his gifts, and through it, he being dead still speaks. Without that. So, you go back and look at Genesis. God had regard for Abel's sacrifice. And you still see Abel speaking. You see Abel referenced you see Abel still speaking today through the scriptures. You look at Enoch. We just covered Enoch. Enoch, not much said about Enoch. Three or four verses back in Genesis and a couple up in Jude. So he's a very short character in terms of history. And it's sort of like Melchizedek. But the statement is made back in Genesis that Enoch walked with God. So here's another faithful man. And how did he do that? He did it because of his trust in God. Six makes this comment and without faith it is impossible to please him, for he who comes to God must believe he is, and he's a rewarder of those who seek him. Acting that self-evident. You're not going to go to something you don't believe exists. So, the first part of that is, without faith is possible to him, for he who comes to God must believe that he is. Well, you wouldn't come to him if you didn't believe that he is, so that's our self-evident. But also, and this is not a self-evident, he's a rewarder of those who seek him. And again, we're going to see that in chapter 11, these other people falling into that category. And remember, the message is faith. Sustain your faith. And as these men demonstrated throughout their life. Verse 7, we have Noah introduced. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, reverently prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. It's hard. At least it is for me. Maybe it's not so hard for you. It's hard for me to imagine if you're Abraham. If you're there are two people, Noah and Abraham, that always try to put yourself in their shoes and wonder what kind of faith did they have? Well, they had a tremendous faith. I mean, here's Noah. We've already talked about a little bit. In terms of something that's going to happen, he's told to build an ark. It goes on for 100 years or so. building this thing for some event that he's never seen before. And does he have a lot of friends? Then he ain't helping anybody. He said his family does. And that's the kind of faith that has kind of conviction behind it. He had conviction. He had assurance. He kept on going and trusting God. And that's what that kind of faith is. It isn't simply a belief of God. Abraham is the other one. Abraham comes up in 8. And this talks about him leaving his land. And then later talks, we'll see in chapter 11, talking about the sacrifice of Isaac. To me, the sacrifice of Isaac, well, both of them were pretty amazing, but the faith that Abraham shows in the sacrificing of Isaac is another one of those that is hard to fathom.
Unbelievable.
I mean, here is a man who's been promised that he would have blessings come through his lineage, and specifically through this promised son. And he's got this son. And now he's being told by the God that gave him the promise, sacrifice him. Okay. And that's the kind of faith that excels. I mean, it's hard, in my case at least, for me to imagine what I would have done under similar circumstances. And rightly so, Abraham is commended by God and by this writer. So by faith, Abraham, in this case, as I was saying, talking about his going out and the promise first being made to him. Going, he was called, when he was called, obeyed, and by going out to the place which he was to receive for inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, and as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundation, whose architect and builder is God. So he has something in view that went beyond walking on this earth, didn't he? And it's the same thing is true in terms of the number of these people. They had a view that went beyond life on this earth. And we see that certainly in Abraham. By faith, even Sarah herself received the ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. So, God made a promise to Abraham and Sarah. He made a promise to Abraham specifically in terms of the lineage and the blessings that would occur to him and people that would come after him, the nations that would rise up after him, and of course what's important to you and me is the blessing of all nations through what would ultimately be the seed, his seed, to produce Christ. And so you look at these two people in their 90s and late 90s, I guess 100 even, and having a child when it was unheard of, but they had faith. Were you going
to say something? I was going to say, you said you didn't know how you would do that with your son or whatever it is, but God spared you.
Yes.
And with the rams and
right,
I am at all. So
you didn't know that when
he
started.
No, he was going to do it.
Okay, believe it or not, we're going to start on 22, excuse me. Continue our chapter 11. I know that's fast, but I intend to go through 11 fast. But you're stopping.